Hello, my name is Siddhartha Ribeiro, and it's a pleasure to be at the Festival de la Mente to talk about sleep and dreams. I will begin the presentation here. So we'll talk today about two phenomena that we all experience every night. We all sleep every night, most of us, and those that don't get sick. And we all dream at night. With the exception of the few people that have some brain lesion that prevents us from dreaming. But we may not realize that we dream every night because we don't pay so much attention to it. What we need to face when we have these phenomena in front of us is that they evolved over a long period of time. So if we want to understand sleep and dreams, we need to understand how they evolved. Just like in the case of an onion, it has several layers and we cannot get to the core of it without passing through all the layers. So evolution brought us here. How did we get here? At the beginning of life on Earth, 4 billion years ago, there was already day and night. So that was a selection pressure, and all life evolved under a regime of alternation of light and darkness and availability of energy and lack of that. And that's why we find circadian rhythms in all organisms that we look into. Many years later, 3.5 billion years later, the first multicellular organisms began to evolve. Like today, we have anemones and jellyfish that represent these early multicellular organisms. And they already had neurotransmitters, just like we have neurotransmitters in our brains. These animals already have these molecules. And they already could approach things which were positive. Like food, and they also could avoid things which were threatening. So they had chemotaxis, and this is the first principle of approaching what is good, of desiring what is good, and avoiding what is bad. And this is, we'll see how this has an impact on how we dream. 400 million years ago, insects began to evolve, and we now see insects as animals that really sleep and not just rest. This has been shown over the past 30 years. And so we can think of sleep as a very ancient manner to deal with this circadian alternation of light and darkness. A long time later, 220 million years ago, mammals began to evolve. And what we see in mammals is that they all share some amazing features in terms of their neurophysiological apparatus. They all have very long REM sleep, in contrast with birds and some reptiles that have very short snippets of REM sleep. Mammals have long REM sleep that can go over 1 hour in some species. They seem to dream. We of course we are not entirely sure because they cannot report their experiments that disinhibit muscles during REM sleep, and the animals will act out the classical experiments performed by Michel Jouvet in Lyon. And these animals are characterized by play, so we could see that dreaming and playing have a resemblance in the sense that they both simulate some reality. It's not just reality, but reality plus something, or with some changes to reality. If we think of our ancestors in terms of just the Homo sapiens and not the other human species that existed until quite recently, we have to think that our hardware, our biological structure was ready, about 315,000 years ago, which is the earliest evidence of Homo sapiens, which was revealed a few years ago in Morocco. So, if the hardware has been ready all this time, what really has changed is the software, is what is the culture, is what goes in our minds. So, of course, we don't have fossilized evidence of the mental apparatus of our ancestors at this time. But we can speculate that our ability to daydream, our ability to move back and forth through time, our ability to imagine the future at many different timescales, and also to recall the past at many different timescales, and almost effortlessly. So you can go be driving, going home, and at the same time be imagining what you will do tonight and what you'll do a year from now or 20 years from now, at the same time go back to your childhood. This traveling in time is probably uniquely human. And one speculation that I create in my book is that our ability to daydream came from our ability to do dreaming at night, that somehow our ability to imagine things is an invasion of dreaming into waking life. Over this very long Paleolithic night, we came out of the caves, right? And we developed a lot of culture slowly in the beginning and then faster and faster and faster as time passed by. So between 500,000 and 25,000 years, we developed more tool use. The tools became much more sophisticated. We began to control fire. There's evidence as early as 300,000 years ago in Homo erectus, not even Homo sapiens, of ritual burials. So many animals show grief when relatives die, but we are the only species that bury them, are dead with a lot of care and with increasing complexity as prehistory developed. And there's also the evidence of cave art about 65,000 years ago. And then the earliest domestication of animals, which was the dog domestication around 25,000 years ago. I want to stress the occurrence of ritual burials, because if we don't think of that, we cannot really understand what happened to our minds. So the question here is, people were dreaming of dead relatives probably regularly, probably every other night, just like we dream when our relatives die. How did our ancestors interpret those dreams? How do we interpret those dreams? Oh, we can say, well, I had REM sleep and I had a dream and activity passed through my neurons. And then I had a dream about my mom that has died. But how did our ancestors interpret those dreams? They could not interpret in terms of REM sleep or brain or neuron. They were compelled to interpret those dreams as dreams with people that were still living, that somehow existed, that somehow were alive after death. And this is very important because this was probably how we managed to accumulate so much culture that we were able to so fast get out of the caves and get to this contemporary world. Why? Because there were no libraries, there was no internet, there was no Wikipedia. Knowledge was embodied. Knowledge was in the bodies of the people that came before us. So if somebody died, there was not just the mourning for the loss of that life and the longing, but also the mourning and the longing for the knowledge that was disappearing with that person. And to dream with dead ancestors was a way to continue propagating that knowledge and to come up with new solutions to problems that allowed us to accumulate culture. So the human mind evolved through oral and gestural narratives of the actions of others, which means that we had the theory of mind. This is a technical term just to mean that while one can be sure that he or she has a mind, you can only infer the minds of others. And you can say, well, probably people have a mind like mine, but they don't know what I know. This is an ability theory of mind that develops early on through childhood. Around 5-6 years of age, children start to really be good at that. This is when they start lying to parents, which is a sign of health at this age, of good health. So what is important here is to understand that although mammals had REM sleep and dreaming probably for over 200 million years, and this was the beginning of what I call the probabilistic oracle, a machine to simulate the future, a biological machine to simulate the probability of something happening in the future. This is probably very old, but what is not so old and probably uniquely human is the ability to share those experiences with others, making those individual dreams collective. So people, either alive or dead, were remembered in waking and also seen in dreams, giving birth to the earliest mental representations of what we now call spirits, entities that live forever after dying, and typically ancestors mixed with animals, plants, and inanimate natural objects. In my book, I go into detail in how the neurophysiological activity during REM sleep, which is more noisy than during other phases of sleep, may contribute to this mixing of representations. So this really started a whole new game in terms of the human culture, because we started to deal with a whole world that was always there, that was eternal, and it wouldn't go away, in lots and lots of different entities. The evidence that this was so is very strong. We have to think of the cult of the dead that just became stronger and stronger and more effort put into burials. and gave rise to the notion that all things, animate and inanimate, have some sort of spirit, animism, or that specific spirits, mixtures of humans and animals, are the ancestors of this particular lineage, totemism, or the notion of gods, which is to really decouple from the human existences and go to this further plane of complexity and power, like, for example, Oshun, the Yoruba goddess of divination and waterfalls and love, etc. So there's plenty of evidence of ritual burials throughout the world, throughout the Paleolithic and the Neolithic. And then this apex of the cult of the dead is reached between 12 and 3,000 years ago, when we have the rise of agriculture, cities and empires, moralizing gods, trade, money, writing. And if we start looking to the evidence that begins after the invention of writing, there are dreams all over. As soon as writing is invented, 4,500 years ago, approximately, you see evidence of dreaming going on and dreaming of with the ability to even predict the future. The dream of Dumuzid, one very early dream report present, one of the earliest texts in humankind, 2500 before Christ. This is a dream about, it's a big nightmare. It's a dream about a king, Dumuzid, who's married to a goddess, and he has this dream of being attacked by men, which are actually demons, and comes to his sister, asks for help, gets the help of many gods, but in the end gets to be captured and killed and sent to hell. So this is a prototypical nightmare. Later, we will see dreams with this premonitory quality, like Joseph interpreting the Pharaoh's dream. The Bible is ridden with those kinds of examples of dreams. And in the antiquity, Artemidorus and Macrobius came to the notion that dreams could reflect the past, the present, or the future. And when represented the future, it could be an allegory of the future, or it could be a direct representation of the future. In this case, they were called theorematic dreams. A very strong example of theorematic dream is the dream of Calpurnia, wife of Julius Caesar, in the night that preceded his assassination. Caesar had the dream in which he traveled through the sky, past the clouds, and met with Jupiter, and Jupiter shook his hand. This was an allegory of his death, because after dying, he actually became divinized, Divus Iulius. But Calpurnia had a dream exactly depicting what would happen, a dream in which Julius would go to the Senate and be killed by senators with daggers. And this is exactly what happened. How is this possible? Divinatory dreams are really, really all over the place, and we will find them very well reported in hunter-gatherer cultures that exist today. For example, Amerindian cultures, both in North America and South America, the famous dream of Sitting Bull, who defended the Lakota and the Cheyenne and the Arapaho from the attacks of the military, the American military, led by George Custer. Sitting Bull had this dream that the soldiers would attack this faraway place where the Amerindians were staying, and then that allowed them to remove the braves from the adults, fighters from the camp. And when Custer attacked, he was totally engulfed by this force that came and killed most of the soldiers. This is a representation of the Lakota of the same event. In South America, there are many examples of the art of dreaming to obtain information, to obtain names, songs, to obtain a variety of cultural items, and to obtain guidance. A very strong example is the chief Apoena, which means he who sees far away, who can be seen on the left side here, a Shavante chief, a group of Amerindian group that exists in the center of Brazil. And in the 40s, Apoena changed the course of the contact between the Xavante and the Brazilian government by seeking to tame the whites. And that was a strategy that was inspired by dreams. And I tell it in detail in my book. So dreaming to obtain warning about the future and to obtain some sort of adaptation to reality is something that is very widespread throughout human culture. as far as we have a historical record and in anthropology and ethnography. So this is actually the default state, the standard situation of the human mind until about 500 years ago, when capitalism and science began to develop in an intertwined manner. And then it stopped being acceptable to say that a king or a queen or a trader made a decision based on a dream. Although dreams continue to influence human history, it was no longer acceptable to say that a dream was the main justification for a particular action. So if we think of dreams as some sort of a way to get insight into the future, uncertain way, probabilistic way, not entirely guaranteed, but also not to be discarded. After science and capitalism began their marriage, the way to look into the future was the acceptable way to look into the future became something that involved logic and calculus and quantification of predictions. And in that sense, the dream really lost ground. Until Sigmund Freud looked again into dreams for meaning, because at this point people were saying, well, dreams have no meaning. Dreams are just something that happens when you eat too much and you get a nightmare. And Freud said, no, dreams have meaning. And in particular, he said in the interpretation of dreams in 1900 that dreams contain day residues, meaning that they reflect what happens in waking life, that they are guided by desires, that dreams are the royal road to the unconscious. Around the same time, a little later, people started to show that indeed sleep favors memory retention. So Jenkins and Dalembert performed an experiment in 1924 that showed that people that learned nonsense syllables would have a better retention of those syllables if they had the opportunity to sleep. So Freud did not say that sleep favors learning, but when he said that day residues are to be found in dreams, if we learn during the day, then therefore we should be learning during dreams as well. And this was the first indication. There are many, many experiments performed after that, and it's very well established now that sleep is important for memory consolidation. What are the mechanisms for this? What could be going on to explain this? One important aspect is the notion of memory reactivation. So neurons that are activated during the day, during memorable experiences that are either very, very pleasant or very, very unpleasant and therefore meaningful, these experiences get to be reactivated through the reactivation of neurons. This has been shown in many animals, including humans. This is a particularly nice example in the zebra finch, an Australian bird. And you can see that the four neurons of the RA nucleus, a nucleus that is involved in the generation of song syllables, the song, which is shown here in the center in red and yellow, this is time in the x-axis and frequency in the y-axis. This is a representation of the song. When the animal sings the song, each neuron in RA will have a particular signature of activity, which you can see here in the line that says song. Every vertical line represents the firing of a neuron. And when the animals go to sleep, they sort of reactivate the same pattern. This has a molecular counterpart because memories cannot exist forever in the active mode. They need to, at some point, become latent, passive. And therefore, the storage of memories in the beginning, it depends on electrical activity, but then later it depends on molecular changes and changes to the gene expression. This is an example. It's a small list of the molecules involved in the entry of calcium in cells that will allow for short-term memories to become long-term memories. And I have shown during my PhD that if you study two groups of animals, animals that were bored and animals that were in their home cages and animals that were exposed to novel stimuli, you will find amazing differences in how they express genes related to learning. When animals are in the bored condition, there's strong expression of this gene ZIF268 related to memory consolidation during waking, but it's decreased during slow wave sleep and REM sleep. As you can see here, as the colors become from red and yellow go to blue, which means a decrease in the expression of the gene. However, when animals are exposed to novelty before the experiment, they will start with high expression in waking, it will go down during slow wave sleep, the non-dreaming phase of sleep, and then it will go up again during REM sleep, suggesting that during REM sleep, animals are reactivating their memories, not just as at the electrical level, but also at the molecular level. So you could think of this as a molecular day residue in the Freudian sense. So think of the brain of a newborn as this very plain, unmarked topography. So very few memories there. The memories that are there are phylogenetic, memory to how to cry, how to suckle, how to sleep, how to learn. And over time, as the baby encounters the world and gets impressed by the world, sulks and marks are made in this topography. And now we're going to look into the brain of the same person 90 years later, and it will look something like this, like the Grand Canyon, many crevices, many possible paths for the flow of water. If you think of a little water flowing in a river as a memory, how many memories are there? Many, many memories, okay? And when the person goes to sleep, activity will spread through the brain and hits the cortex, and the activity will activate those memories that are more deeply carved. That's why people, when they go to war and they get traumatized, every time they rest, every time they sleep, they tend to have a nightmare that brings them back to that traumatic experience. So could it be that this is all that happens, that dreams are just the passage of electrical activity through a particular chain of neurons? Well, not exactly. In the late 90s and early 2000s, Mark Solms, a neurologist and a psychoanalyst in South Africa, studied many cases of injuries of brain lesions to conclude that injury to the dopaminergic reward punishment circuits abolished dreaming but not REM sleep. That means the people that have a lesion to the cell bodies that produce dopamine in the ventral tegmental area and distribute this through axons that are widely spread through the brain, if there are lesions to those neurons or to their axons, people will still have REM sleep, but will no longer dream, which decouples dreaming from REM sleep and says that dreaming is more than just activating memories. It's activating memories with a purpose, with the purpose of avoiding punishment or seeking reward, which is what those dopaminergic signals are involved into. So what is the function of dreaming? What is dreaming good for? This question started to be solved also at the turn of the century with the work of Antti Revonsuo and Katja Valli in Finland. And they compared dreams of children in the Gaza Strip with children in Jordan. And they said, well, if they have the same culture and they have very different dreams, what is going on? What is the difference? And they found that indeed they had very different dreams. The children in Gaza had many more nightmares. And the only difference was the civil war, was the violence going around. And they came up with this idea that the nightmare is the prototypical dream. The dreams evolved as a way to warn us against impending threats. And this idea is interesting because most human dreams, and this is a comparison of studies all over the world, will say that the majority of human dreams have a negative tone, have an anxious tone, have somehow more to the negative than to the positive. And I'm using those images by Grete Stern to illustrate, because she's such a good artist, an amazing Argentinian German photographer that composed images that really evoke the bizarreness of dreams. But we also have to think, oh, this is in Portuguese, that the nightmare of some animals could be the pleasant dream of other animals. So we can imagine that the dreams of zebras and lions are exactly the same, except that they have inverse polarity. When zebras have a pleasant dream, lions have a nightmare. Now, what distanced us from this world of life and death all the time and dreaming about that all the time was culture, right? It distanced us from these three Darwinian imperatives: to kill, not to die, and to procreate. And as we accumulated culture, we came up with a lot of new desires and a lot of new necessities. And this oracle, this probabilistic oracle that dreams evolved into, that allowed us to every day kill something to eat, not die, and to find partners to procreate, this oracle began to lose accuracy, right? It's very it's very easy to understand that with a few variables, a probabilistic oracle can often be right. But as we get more and more complex, as we go from the caveman to the complexity of the world of Proust and the Madeleines that he used to begin his main book, then we have to say, well, now how can a dream of a man that lives in such a complicated world of small desires, how can this dream predict the future? And dreams then become a bricolage, a complex mixture of things in your life that don't really come together unless you have a very strong, clear problem. Somebody died, somebody will die, there's a disease, you may lose your job. And then dreams become, again, very organized and very provide a lot of insight into the situation. We have to talk about Carl Jung and the creatures of the mind. Jung developed this notion that in our minds, we do not have just the self, just the person that says I, but also many, many other representations that have a great degree of autonomy. And even though this idea seemed very awkward for science at the time, it got a lot of support in recent years as we discovered that the brain does have representations of individual entities, which are quite invariant. I'm referring here particularly to the work of Rodrigo Quiroga in Leicester University, has found neurons that respond, for example, to Luke Skywalker in the hippocampus of humans in a very precise manner to very many different versions of Luke Skywalker, including his name as it's written or his name as it's pronounced, and his face in many different profiles, and even responds a little bit to Master Yoda, but does not respond to Leonardo DiCaprio or many other artists. So the point here is that in our brains, we do have representations of creatures of the mind. And these are the creatures that we encounter when we dream. And these are the creatures that were so important across thousands of years to accumulate embodied knowledge. Now, creativity in the encounter with these entities and with these representations has been strongly documented in the arts. Many painters used dreams to produce material for their work. For example, the dream caused by the flight of a bee around a pomegranate 1 second before waking up by Dalí. In science, there are also many, many examples. Kekulé discovered the circular structure of benzene in a dream. Mendeleev discovered the structure of the periodic table in a dream. And Otto Loewi discovered how acetylcholine plays a role in controlling the function of the heart also in a dream, and got the Nobel Prize for that. The first evidence in science that sleep is involved in creativity came from the laboratory of Jan Born, who's now in Tübingen. And this is amazing work that showed that people can discover the implicit structure of a stimulus by having access to sleep. More recently, Sarah Mednick and also Matt Walker and certainly Robert Stickle in Harvard came up with more evidence that sleep, and in particular REM sleep, is involved in creativity. Bob Stickle in Harvard came up with the first demonstration that dreaming with a certain task favors the execution of that task. So dreaming is actually adaptive. Subjects that were asked to navigate a labyrinth, a maze, became much better at that after they slept and had mentation about the task. That means that had a dream about the task. And this didn't happen when they stayed awake. Even when they thought about the maze, the effect was not there. I also want to mention, in conclusion, work in my own laboratory, in which we have shown that dream reports are particularly useful for psychiatric diagnosis. If you ask people about what they have done in the previous day, if you ask patients with schizophrenia, with bipolar disorder or controls, you get pretty much the same kind of reports. Every red circle here represents a word, and the arrows represent the sequence of words. So basically, they will tell you a linear discourse with a few loops, but the structure is not really very different, as you can see in the bottom. In the waking reports, the schizophrenia, bipolar, and control subjects cannot be really differentiated. However, when you ask about the dream, then they get really, really different. As you can see, the patients with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder are completely different. In schizophrenia, they are very, very, they have poor expression, few words, while in bipolar disorder, they will go all over the place with many, many words, flights of thoughts, many recurrences, and the controls in between. So the dream reports are especially informative about psychosis, and we have confirmed this in a further study in which we compared dreams with stories told about images with positive, negative, and neutral effects, memories of yesterday, the oldest memory the person could come up with, and still dreams came up on top. So Freud was right on this. Dreams somehow carry more information about the mind of the dreamer than other kinds of reports. In conclusion, I want to say the following. We can translate what Freud said over 100 years ago in a manner that agrees with both biology and psychology. To say that dreams contain day residues is also to say that dreams reverberate memories at the molecular and electrophysiological levels. To say that dreams are guided by desires is to say that dreams reverberate memories so as to simulate expectations of reward and punishment mediated by dopamine. And to say that dreams are the royal road to the unconscious could be translated in contemporary terms as saying that dreams allow accessing the bank of memories and their possible combinations, allow activating creativity and revealing the structure of the dreamer's mind. Now, if the dream can do all that, if the combination of sleep and dreaming is so powerful in terms of adaptation and in terms of our cognitive encounter with the world, what is going on now that people have forgotten the art of dreaming and that we no longer use dreaming as guidance for our future? What is the future of dreaming in this planet? And I want to conclude with this image of the Yanomami shaman Davi Kopenawa and quoting his book, The Fall of the Sky, in a book written also with Bruce Alberts. And he says, the Shapiri, the spirits, are already announcing all this to us, although the whites think that they are lies. If they destroy the forest, the sky will break again and it will fall to the earth. But whites do not listen. They too will die, crushed by the fall of the sky. There will be nothing left. So it is. Kopenawa is talking about this current crisis in the planet in which our lack of insight into the future, our lack of insight into the consequences of our actions is destroying the planet, is in particular destroying the Amazon, and now during the pandemic, threatening the lives of everybody. So if we are to survive in this planet and find a way to survive in this planet, it must be to bring the art of dreaming back into our lives, to bring dreaming back into our common discussion, conversation in our families, to pay attention to dreaming, to sleep better, and to stop acting like we do not know the consequences of our actions. If dreaming could be rescued, if we can rescue the art of dreaming together with science and with all the capital that has been accumulated, we could very, very easily fix the planet. However, if we still continue to abandon the art of dreaming and promote the destruction of our environment and of our social structure, then we might not have a future in the planet. Let's see what happens. Thank you.